Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Allen. Later on in this segment, I'll be talking to Democrat gubernatorial candidate Sri Tanandar. But first up, we talk to our Congressman Jack Bergman.
Hey, good morning, Rick.
I'm glad to hear from you again.
Well, I can picture me sitting in your little office space right there, so I'll just pretend we're together.
Absolutely. Works well for me. We haven't had a chance to speak since the shooting at the ball practice there. And first of all, I want to say that I'm really glad that you're all right. And what a scary situation that had to have been.
Well, when I, in the Marine Corps, I expected to be shot at because that was the nature of our mission, okay? But you didn't expect that going to baseball practice. So God was with us in so many different ways that day, and I'm just thankful to be talking to you today, and thankful that all my colleagues are doing well and towards recovery.
Now, have there been any changes in security following that?
Well, the short answer is yes. First of all, there was a very robust debate about what do we do next. And, in the end, with 435 members of Congress, 100 senators, you're talking 535 people, it absolutely did not make any sense to try to provide personal security for everyone. But we have been able to look at what is the potential threat. For example, we were at a public park for the baseball practice. When you have a public event, there's going to be some security now. Right now, those of us who've chosen to play in the next charity event, which is the congressional football game, anybody who's ever seen the movie The Longest Yard knows it was the guards versus the inmates. Well, in this case, we're the inmates. It's bipartisan. But there will be security when we're practicing out on the mall in preparation for the game. So little changes that make sense.
Okay. All right. Well, you guys had to get back to work eventually, and then the big thing on the docket was the Affordable Care Act. Many Republicans, including yourself, campaigned on repealing it, replacing it, doing something entirely different. However, it wasn't able to get done. What happened?
Well, as you just said, it passed the House after, a little bit of a fit and start. But it passed, and we sent it to the Senate, and the Senate decided it didn't like it. So now we as a Congress still have the responsibility to ensure that our citizens have health care. So the next steps will be, I think, determined by the Senate and the House, working together to say, okay, what can we actually get done? What can we actually get passed? Because in the end, there's no silver bullet, one size fits all solution. We, especially here in the UP, we need to make sure that, first of all, we have healthcare providers that actually are, the folks can go to. We're very rural. We're not an urban environment, so our needs are going to be different. So what I'm focused on is making sure that there are healthcare providers and that those providers get paid for their services. I mean, it's not really all that complicated when you talk about what we're trying to do. Where it gets complicated is everybody wants to add a little ingredient to the recipe, and then you don't get what you want.
The president has said if Congress isn't able to come up with a replacement, then just to either repeal or just let it die out, the Affordable Care Act. Is that a viable solution for the people in your district?
Well, let's put it this way. My military background, if you swear an oath, and then part of that oath says you're going to do the right thing, and if the right thing is you see something that's wrong and you don't do something about it, it's called dereliction of duty. Congress has the responsibility to ensure that we ensure that there's health care provided, for the citizens. So in the UP here, we're going to be busy just trying to figure out what do we have in place, what's not working, and what's not available. One example, of course, is the expansion of telehealth. I believe in the UP, we have a great opportunity to expand the care available at some of the initial levels for, let's say, patient assessment using telehealth, mobile telehealth. So we're kind of an incubator area up here to try new forms of healthcare delivery, and I'm working towards that.
I'm going to ask you some questions later on here if I got time about the Veterans Act for small businesses, because I know that that was a big thing that you were pushing. But before we get to that, what hit the news, of course, last week and then earlier this week, the president's ban on transgender servicemen and women, you being a 40-year veteran of the Marine Corps, what was your reaction to that?
Well, you know, number one, and I'll say this for everybody in the United States to hear, and especially everybody who has served the United States military, the United States military is not somebody's social science experiment. Okay? We have an all-recruited force, not a draft. Like when guys like, you know, when I was that age eligible, we were classified anywhere from 1A in draft classification down to 4F and anything in between. There is a commission right now that has been chartered, well, it was under the last administration. They're just starting their work to take a look at, do we even need a selective service system? And if we do, what are the qualifications for service? When you talk about a young man or woman joining the United States military, they sign an 8-year contract, and depending on the contract they sign, probably its maximum going to be about 4 or 5 years most of active duty. We need to make sure that that young man or woman who joins and successfully completes boot camp is deployable during that time. And that's the key. So whatever the issue is, if there's anything that's going on that makes them not deployable for a long period of time, then they're not of use to their unit. So that's kind of where I stand on that.
Well, what would make a transgender individual not deployable?
Well, let's put it this way: if you go through the therapy and the treatment and all of those type of things, that will take you out of the loop for probably 12 to 18 months.
Okay, there was a measure that called for prohibiting the military from paying for medical procedures for transgender soldiers, and you voted against that. You had an explanation put out on your Facebook page that I saw, but I wanted to give you a chance to address that for people that are listening who may be confused on, you know, why support a ban on transgender soldiers but then not vote against keeping military funding from providing for the medical procedures.
Well, you know, I believe, and I think most of the people in this country would agree with me, especially those who pay taxes, is that the federal government should spend $0 for elective surgery, whether it's someone wants, you know, a new nose, new eyelids, you know, all of that is elective surgery. So from my standpoint, my no vote was twofold. Number one, I didn't believe that they had the amendment that was proposed should go through the NDAA process. It was the wrong place. General Mattis, Secretary of Defense Mattis, had asked for a 3-month extension to finish reviewing the policy. It was not Congress's business to micromanage the Secretary of Defense, who's probably one of the finest warfighters in the history of this nation and a very thoughtful individual. We were getting into his business when we didn't need to be, and as a military commander, give me the mission, give me the resources, don't tell me how to get it done. So I believe that that amendment, while the intent was good, the execution and the timing of it was absolutely off base, and that's why I voted against it.
Thank you for that. You had a piece of legislation called the Protecting Business Opportunities for Veterans Act. This was said to protect veterans who are small business owners. How does it protect them?
Well, what it does, there have been small businesses through service, you know, service disabled veteran owned businesses. They get the opportunity to basically make money through set aside contracts, and what happens is some these set-aside contracts have not been monitored to the point where the small business is actually doing the work. It's being passed through. There have been layers of cost added, and the small business, the veteran-owned business, really doesn't benefit from it. So that was the intent of this law, is to make sure that those set-aside contracts were actually focused on and work performed by the small veteran-owned businesses.
Last question. You voted in favor of the Make America Secure Appropriations Act. A couple of things that stood out here is, one, there's some additional funding for the Sioux Locks, which is important to your district, and also a pay raise for military service members. For a bipartisan piece of legislation, nearly 200 people voted against it, but you were in support of it. How come?
Well, number one, it says right in the preamble to the Constitution, provide for the common defense. So it's the Congress's responsibility to make sure that America and Americans and our citizens are secure. Our troops need to be paid at a rate that reflects the fact that it is a living wage. Even if you're that new 18-year-old private who, you know, maybe is already married, you have to pay them enough so that they can not worry about if they're going to have food on the table, and they can focus on their military mission.
The call dropped briefly for a second, but we got the congressman back on the line.
Not sure what happened.
Oh, I don't know either.
Call got dropped. Apologize for that. If we're in the UP.
Well, you know, you're right. And one of the challenges that we have, as you know, is our communication services are not what they need to be, whether you're a student in high school or you're a senior citizen trying to just do the business now that can't be done in person or can't be done over the phone, whatever. We got a ways to go here in the UP.
Sure do. Now, I know you have a lot going on today. I don't want to hold you up too much longer. I just, with the recess going on right now, when that's over and you go back to Washington, what will be the focus?
Well, the focus is that we're going to move forward with tax reform, because of the fact is that we know that if we don't do the tax reform necessary in this country, it's been overdue for a long time. It's been, you know, over 30 years since the last one in 1986. Without that tax reform, the money that needs to be in the pockets of Americans is not going to stimulate the economy that drives everything else. And somehow, whether it be through the tax reform or the workforce changes and regulations with getting more people involved with technical jobs and technical training, that's the only way we're going to get the economy growing so that people can actually earn a living, raise a family, live in a community. And so that's tax reform when we get back.
Congressman, thank you for your time, and I look forward to your next trip up to Houghton.
Sounds good, Rick. We'll let you know when we're coming, and so hopefully I can do a, you know, an in-studio interview with you next time.
Sounds great. Thanks. Thanks to Congressman Jack Bergman for talking to me on today's show. Next, we talk to Democratic gubernatorial candidate Sri Tanidhar.
Good morning, Rick. This is Sri Tanidhar.
Thank you for calling, Sri. It's nice to be able to get a chance to talk to you. We're doing this segment for Copper Country Today, and we'll call this kind of like a get-to-know-you time here, because you're going to come back here. You were just in Houghton, but at some point we'll have you in studio for a longer interview. So I thought this would be a good time to just introduce yourself to our listeners here and tell them a little bit about yourself.
Yes. So, Rick, I am a scientist, and I am a entrepreneur, having run small businesses for the last 25 years, creating jobs, chemicals, testing labs. That's what I've owned, innovating, developing new medicine, as well as solving industrial quality-related problems. I'm a problem solver primarily. And let me go back to back in when I grew up in southern India in a small town, and education was the ladder for me to come out of poverty. I worked as a janitor to help my family come out of poverty. got a bachelor's degree in chemistry, a master's in chemistry, and in Akron, Ohio, I got a PhD in chemistry back in 1982. In 82, I came to Michigan and worked at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor as a postdoctoral scholar, again, doing research, innovation, invention. In 1988, I became a United States citizen, which was my lifelong dream. And I bought a little company in 1990 that was solving chemical-related problems. If there's food contamination, what's the cause of it? If a paint that Ford Motor Company is buying is failing and causing chipping, what went wrong in the manufacturing process? So my company would solve such problems. The company started growing under my leadership. And in 1996, the company had grown to about 20 employees and about $2 million in revenue. At the time, my boys, I have two boys, my older one, Neil, was 8 years old, younger one, Samir, was 4 years old, and my first wife unexpectedly died.
Sorry to hear that.
And I had to be, yes, and I had to be, not only deal with my own grief, but help the children recover their grief and raise them as a single parent, as well as running a small business. In 1999, I got remarried to my current wife, and I continued to grow my business. The business grew to about 500 employees. Now, these are all good, high-paying jobs. Average salary is somewhere in the $60,000, $70,000. And then came the 2008 recession. And like many Michigan businesses, my business had difficulty in the recession because many of my customers were small biotech venture-funded companies. And the venture funding dried up. And many of my customers went belly up in the recession, and that impacted my business. So the bank ended up foreclosing on my business, foreclosing on my house. And in 2010, the bank got paid every dollar I owed. But I lost a lot, and I lost what I had built up over the years. In 2010, I came to Ann Arbor, Michigan, and restarted my company. And I grew that company in the last 6 years, won many awards, created 50 high-paying jobs in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Every job I ever created in my company was created in the United States of America. Not a single job was outsourced anywhere else. And last year, I felt that I have done good for me and my family, and it's time for me to give back. So I sold the company last year, gave a small portion of the sale price, distributed that to all of my employees, and put a little bit of that money into my campaign and started my campaign for governor.
Well, being in the shadow of Michigan Tech here, people in this area will certainly appreciate your education and what you did business-wise. But the first question they would ask is, why dive into the realm of, you know, Michigan politics? It almost seems like a step down coming from where you were.
Well, you know, I'm a scientist at heart. And I see a lot of science-related issues, whether it is climate control or clean air or clean water, or what happened in Flint, Michigan, or our infrastructure issues, the failing bridges, the crumbling roads. This is all science, engineering. And I want to make a difference. I chose to be in public service and chose to run as a governor because as a governor, I think I can make the biggest impact in Michigan. And my goal is to improve the quality of life for all Michiganders.
Do you feel that you're at a disadvantage since you haven't been in, you know, in politics and maybe kind of a, you know, unknown going into this? I mean, you got to going up against big names like Gretchen Whitmer and such.
Oh, absolutely. You know, there are advantages and there are disadvantages. The disadvantage certainly is that I am not as well known as some of my opponents. And for that reason, I put $3.3 million of my own personal funds into my campaign so I can go all over Michigan and have a dialogue with voters. And that's what I'm doing. I was in St. Sumary on Wednesday, I believe, Tuesday. Yesterday I was at Houghton Democratic Club. Today I am going to be speaking at Marquette Democratic Club. Tomorrow I will be in Muskegon talking with Democrats there. And so after selling my business, I am full-time devoting to campaigning and governing. And so I intend to take my campaign throughout Michigan, talk about issues. The advantage is that I am not a career politician. So I am not beholden to the corporation. Often what happens is that the career politicians over the years get enough donations from big billion-dollar companies and corporations and sometimes the dark money. And then they get, you know, it's a pay-for-play culture. And they get beholden to the lobbyists and the dark money. Now, I have no one to answer to. And my loyalty is to the people of Michigan. And being a scientist, I am going to look at things in an objective way and find common sense, pragmatic solutions. So I feel that once my name gets out and people know my issues and my issues are well documented on my website, which is shri2018.com, simply S-H-R-I, shri2018.com. So you could see I have been I have detailed my positions on my website because I believe this is a content-driven campaign. And we need to let people know what we stand for people to be able to make an informed decision.
Of course, things are very divided now. Last presidential election, Michigan surprisingly voted for Donald Trump in the presidential election. There's a lot of talk that the pendulum's going to swing back next, you know, at the gubernatorial election with our own governor who's Republican being term limited. And, you know, the favorites are on the Democrat side. Does that play into your choice to run as a Democrat?
Not really. You know, I don't think we can take that for granted. Basically, I think people are fed up with politicians coming to us, making promises, and when they get elected, they go serve their donors. And we've seen this over and over again, and we wonder why nothing gets done is because of the loyalties. Now, Rick Snyder has a special affinity towards big business, the billion-dollar corporations, and he has made it a point to deliver big incentives to the billion-dollar company. Now, these companies have not shown their loyalty to Michigan. And often, these big companies collect the incentives, which is hundreds of millions of dollars, and they don't deliver to Michigan. Often they come in, take their money, set up a shop, and then they close the shop. So net gain of jobs is essentially zero. And I think we must understand what the voters are looking for. The voters are looking for action. They want things change in their life. And that's what we need to deliver. We need to deliver whether Democrat or Republicans. And I feel that in the general election, my background as a small business owner, being fiscally responsible, my positions, which are putting people over profit, so helping investing in human beings instead of corporate welfare. So that means improving our education system, creating skills and letting, making education affordable, bringing vocational education, trade education in our middle schools and in high schools to prepare a workforce that's skilled so that they can have a quality life. And that is going to appeal to not only the diehard Democrats, but also the independents who will make a big impact in choosing our next governor.
Well, Sheree, I want to say that I know that the people in this area appreciate you coming through the Upper Peninsula, especially early on in this campaign, and giving people a chance to get to know you. And I definitely look forward to your next trip up here where we can sit down in studio and delve deep into some of these issues that you're passionate about.
Absolutely, Rick. I would love to keep coming back, and I'm just going to be available and be around and talk about issues. Let's have a strong primary. And let's have issues and let's discuss the issues and not only what our positions are, but who we are. Look at our life. You know, I didn't come from privilege and I have lived a life where I am probably the only candidate that knows what it feels like to go to bed hungry. I'm the only candidate, either party, that have created jobs in America. And I hope and expect voters to look at who we are, not just what our policies are or what we say, but how we have lived our life and how does that reflect into what we expect to do once we are victorious and in Lansing to change the dialogue.
Thank you again so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Rick.
Copper Country Today. We'll be right back.